Good evening.
Good evening.
It's really wonderful to be here. Redwood City, what a great name. And a tree to prove it. And thank you for the introduction. I was really happy when Gil called and asked me to come and join you for this evening as he comes back from Europe, where he's been and having a wonderful time. I remember very clearly when Gil came to Green Gulch. Years and years ago. Even more clearly than that, I remember when he cast an eye on Tamara and she cast an eye on him. That was really great. Tamara and I worked in the garden for years, and I consider her a sister, a real sister. So I am really delighted to be here tonight and to investigate, to turn the Dharma. You know that wonderful practice in temples in China when the books are taken out once a year and the sutra books are leafed through or aired so that fresh air can come in and the text, the message of the text can go out and be carried on the wind. So I can feel that kind of spirit is very much in your congregation, and it's lovely to be here. I wanted to talk, and it's so perfect because it relates completely to the picnic idea. I wanted to talk with you, or just to ruminate together, about the importance of trees in the life of practice, the importance of being out of doors and practicing in the forest. So perfect to be in Redwood City. You know, Green Gulch Farm is located in the embrace of Redwood Creek watershed. There are many Redwood Creek watersheds in California, but the watershed where I live and work and practice is quite ancient, and it's the ancient quality of the place is really determined by the trees, by the river, by the sky, by the ocean, and by the complexity of the land, and by the rare opportunity to practice within that environment. So we live about 3 miles outside of Muir Woods National Monument. And I'm sure many of you have visited Muir Woods National Monument. And I'm thinking in particular of the life of that forest and what it's been like to meditate and live for 30 years in that watershed, where the waters from the west-facing flanks of Mount Tamalpais run out to the Pacific Ocean, and about 8 different freshets, little creeks, run into Redwood Creek, which is just a short 7-mile run of river, not even really a river. It has a grand name, but it's a miserable little stream, really. That not miserable. It's very beautiful and wild, and you know that 7-mile course of river that's fed by Fern Creek, a Rattlesnake Creek, Green Gulch Creek. Let's see. I'm trying to remember all the names. Well, those come up right away. Rock Springs, all those little rivers that drain the western flanks of the mountain and run out to the ocean, contribute to a small silver river, which is the native home of the silver salmon, which is a rare salmon in the coho salmon line. Now, to practice in a watershed and to have it be the responsibility and enjoyment of the members of the communities, and I don't just hold this to the Zen Center community, but the many communities that live in that part of the world, is an incredible honor, and especially since for a good 100 years, we've been protecting that little narrow sliver of Silver River and making sure that the salmon can come up every winter, come up that little narrow canyon to spawn. And you know, it's amazing. It's really a dinky river. But in that river, we have one of the last unadulterated strains of salmon, not only in the United States, but in the world, which is a real commentary on the situation we find ourselves in right now. So many of the salmon now in the rivers are no longer wild run or free run, but they've been bred, they've been changed around. So I think about that every day as I listen to the river. Actually, the river runs right behind our house out to the ocean. And I really think about it every day, what it means to live and to protect and to practice meditation in that in our watershed. And what it's meant for 100, actually it's such a little time in the real life of the world, just a blink. But those wild fish are still able to make their way north to find the pools that are still 3D pools. Do you know this wonderful teaching about salmon habitat? They need a 3D habitat. It means the 3Ds are deep, dark, and dense shade. I think that's often a good environment for practice, too. Deep in the heart of your vow, feeling the density of life and all the challenges we're facing, and unafraid of the dark, being willing to look at the dark. So I count myself among the fortunate ones to have lived for 30 years in this extraordinarily beautiful place and to have practiced meditation with good Dharma friends like Gil and Tamara. And not only Gil and Tamara, but I also with the pileated woodpeckers and the banana slugs that are so determined, the ancient ones. And to live in a watershed, you know, the Bay Area is one of the designated 13 hotspots in the world, designated by the Nature Conservancy, as areas where there's tremendous biological diversity and worthy of protection, and a kind of hotspot because the world is so lacking in this kind of complexity. So what does it mean to practice in one place and to protect the landscape? It's an incredible honor and challenge, too. And nobody, the wonderful song goes, nobody stays in one place anymore. So many of us move around, and yet you don't have to live in a place for 30 years just to have 30 minutes of meditation where you settle into the 3D quality of your life and intention is an incredible benefit. And I feel that. I feel it very strongly in this hall. How wonderful to have it, too. I remember meeting with you years ago in the church. It's wonderful to be here. There's a wonderful comment from F. Scott Fitzgerald. He says, draw your chair close to the precipice and I'll tell you a story. In Muir Woods National Monument, there's a grove called Bohemian Grove. Do you know Bohemian Grove? Anybody been to Bohemian Grove? Excuse me while I move my leg just a minute. In Bohemian Grove, there is some of the most compacted and uncharacteristic redwood duff soil that I've ever encountered. And because I live very close to Muir Woods, I make a constant effort throughout the year to work, to be involved in the life of that forest. We have a practice of, we call it sneak meditation, where we walk around without bells, drums, whistles, or any other fancy bibs or other garb, and work in the forest whenever a new apprenticeship group of students comes to Green Gulch. And every year, for 6 months, we welcome about anywhere from 6 to 10 students to come and work with us. They have to be crazy. They have to want to, really, they have to be, I'm not kidding. They have to want to sit like a mountain and work like the devil. And we're looking for students or practitioners who will carry the work out into the world after living at Green Gulch. When they arrive, it's been my pleasure for years to kidnap them the first morning. And in silence, we go from Green Gulch by car, not speaking a word, before the light comes up, and we walk in the woods. And every year we break the rules and step off the path, and every year we get caught by a ranger. It seems unbelievable that they make their morning tours and they always find us. But so we've noticed over the years how compacted and stiff the soil is in Bohemian Grove. And I have a good friend who's the site manager of Muir Woods. Whenever people say me as the site manager, that I was head gardener for years, I think, no. Muir Woods runs her life, and the garden certainly ran my life. So it's kind of conventional speech only to say she's the site manager. But she does watch over the woods. And I asked her, why is the soil so compacted in Bohemian Grove? Because in the winter, we've been doing restoration work there one day a year. We have a full day with volunteers from all over the world, really all over the world. About 300 people come and descend into the heart of Muir Woods. And it's in the rainy season. And even if it's been pouring and torrential rain, it almost always clears up enough to allow us into the woods for that one day. And we cross the barriers and we endeavor to repair the tread of human existence. So I have consistently worked in Bohemian Grove because, thanks to mindfulness, I realized how compacted the soil was. And when I asked her, why is the soil so compacted? She said, because of the Buddha. Well, that was provocative. Because of the Buddha. Could you say more? She told me a wonderful story. That in 1892 or 1893... the Bohemian Grove, hence the Bohemian Grove, was named for the Bohemian Club of San Francisco, a group of wild men and women who gathered in the forest to read poetry, to compose free verse, to dance, to sing, to celebrate the wild spirit of the world once a year. And they thought that their main ground would be Bohemian Grove, hence the name. So they settled in this grove and found it lovely and created a huge 43-foot-high model of the Kamakura Buddha from Japan. You know, the Buddha that sits like this. He has a little narrow mudra. He looks kind of constipated. He's there like that. He's kind of fearsome being. He's so huge. Anyway, they made this beautiful white plaster of Paris Buddha, a Buddha as white as my hair is white. In fact, thinking about it makes my hair whiter. Thinking about this gigantic hulking Buddha that they created, and they danced around it. And in fact, there's even a photograph of a few of the members of the Bohemian Grove sitting in the mudra of the Buddha. Did you know this story? Isn't this amazing? I kid you not, this really happened. Fear not. Here's the fear not mudra to assure you, yes, this is true. And they planned to buy Muir Woods so that they would always have a place to meet. So after constructing the Buddha and joining, gathering there in the dark, in the 3D dark of the woods, they grew so cold and frightened and narrow and kind of just overwhelmed by the nature of the place. It was not at all hospitable to the fairies and demons that they wanted to welcome. And so they abandoned the spot and moved up to the Russian River, where there is a Bohemian Grove to this day and where they continue to meet. Hallelujah! Because they were quite a significant presence, and they involved a lot of traffic into the woods. So they left, but they left the Buddha there on the ground. Of course, not bothering to dismantle. And I think it's sad. Mia doesn't know, and a lot of people, nobody seems to really know how long the Buddha remained there. But it was a good many years. And eventually, I think it was jackhammered apart and taken away. But, you know, because I noticed the compaction, I thought, well, it really is my job and vow and commitment as a student of the teaching to endeavor to open up that seized ground, because even a Buddha leaves a heavy trace on the ground. So for 11 years, we've been pickaxing in that blasted Bohemian Grove, and I have discovered few little pieces of white plaster of Paris, kind of the trace of the Buddha, and have noticed how much work it is to follow through, how much work it is to really be connected to a place and to serve, to listen to the voice of the watershed and to respond. Suzuki Roshi, the founder of Zen Center, liked to talk about when you practice, burn yourself up completely and leave no trace. Nothing at all. Offer everything you have to your mindful attention, to bringing the heart and mind together in the present moment, which, as you know, is a translation, Thich Nhat Hanh's translation from the Chinese and the Sanskrit of the character for sati, or smriti, or mindfulness. The upper character, heart and mind together, and the lower character in the present moment. So to bring your heart and mind together in the present moment and leave no trace is an extraordinary challenge. I bring it up tonight because of out of absolute assurance that the Buddha left quite a trace, or that image of the Buddha left quite a trace on the land. And you know, we've worked hard to open the ground so that the soil can receive water, can receive the rain, can receive the tidings of the forest, because the floodplain of the redwoods, the floodplain where redwood trees, where Sequoia sempervirens grow, depends on the addition year after year of, you know, flooding water. And the ground has to be open for the seedlings to start. And that whole area where the Buddha sat had become a barren plain. Absolutely unusually noticeable in the woods because of its compaction. So I've been working there for 10 years, pickaxing, planting seedlings of many different perennial plants and shrubs, even some plants of trees, of in particular the tan oak, which likes to grow on the floor of the redwood forest. And that's been challenging too, to open up the ground, to plant seedlings of the tan oak, to try to do this work in mindfulness. Again, not so apparent, no bowing, no incense, no fuss, no muss, but just dedicating each stroke of the blade to the may the heart of the world be open, may my heart be open, may this ground live again and breathe again, making that kind of vow with every step, and then planting seedlings that have been started by volunteers from all over the Bay Area region. The seedlings of the tan oak are really doing well. And I asked my friend again, why are we planting tan oak in Muir Woods? And she said, to bring wood rats into the forest. I thought, oh, great. This is, rats plague my life as a gardener. Rats are extraordinary beings, and they have incredible life, especially the rats at Green Gulch are kind of, you know how rats are usually furtive and they don't appear during the day? The Green Gulch rats have double chins and appear at all hours. We thought, well, we'll aerate the compost pile to make sure that we have excellent compost here at Zen Center. We don't proselytize about Zen, but we do about compost. Yeah. So we put these perforated pipe into the compost pile, and rats began to live in the pipes. We called them rat hotels. So periodically when we were turning the compost, somebody would have to pull out the pipes and shake them, and these plump rats would come waddling out, look over their shoulders, and not even scurry away. So when I learned that I was breaking up the hard pan caused by the image of the Buddha to plant trees that would entice rats into the forest, and my practice had to drop down another notch into granny gear. And I thought, maybe I should just spend more time in the meditation hall. This is a little arch. What's really happening? And I pursued the topic a bit, and Mia told me that without the wood rats, the spotted owl population of the woods would fall off. And actually, when you look at an old-growth forest There are indicator species that show you that the forest is well, that it's healthy. The spotted owl is one of those indicator species. The silver salmon, dead trees. And there's another, it may be the red-legged frog or the western pond turtle wouldn't be there, but anyway, there's another indicator species. I think the monarch butterfly is also indicates health and complexity. So in order for the spotted owls to be present, they have to have food. So here I am planting tan oaks for the wood rats to feed the spotted owls. And I began to feel the incredible chain of life that is present in practice and in especially when you put your attention into what's happening right underneath your hands and feet. So those trees are about as tall as I am now, some of them. The sword fern are beginning to colonize the area. And except for our traffic into that part of the grove, the woods are coming back to life. So I count myself lucky to have an extensive meditation hall that includes the forest and comes out of the forest. And, you know, I, especially in this season and in these times, when times are grave and tension is high, it is extraordinarily important to be able to take refuge, to fly back, refugio, to what nourishes your body and mind and soul, helps you keep your heart and mind together in the present moment. And for me, that is always returning to the forest. Now, you don't have to live in rural part of Marin like I do to do that, as you well know. And in fact, if each practitioner practiced in a way to make the places where we live a little bit more habitable and alive, not worrying about whether we own the place or whether it owns us, to really make the effort or to make the offering of connecting. Only connect, as E.M. Forrester says. Only connect. To make that effort to connect, to bring the body and mind together, to bring the heart and mind together in the present moment, and to find true ease right where we live, even for a few minutes a day, is an incredible and radical gift. It's a wonderful word, isn't it? The radical word, meaning what a root does, going down. You know, in the redwood forest, the root system of the trees is so extensive that they did an injection of red dye into the root system of one redwood tree, and it appeared a good 2 or 3 acres out from the tree in this network. So the living network, the only true internet, you know, the life of the forest. And we tread upon that and walk upon that and even build Buddhas upon that and forget just for a moment where we come from. So meditation practice is essential to bring us back to our true self and remind us. I have a beautiful poem that I brought from poetess Adrian Rich. It's called The Dark Fields of the Republic. And I think it's very timely. What kind of times are these? There's a place between two strands of trees where the grass grows uphill and the old revolutionary road breaks off into the shadows. Near a meeting house abandoned by the persecuted who disappeared into the shadows. I've walked there, picking mushrooms at the edge of dread, but don't be fooled. This is not somewhere else, but here, our country, moving closer to its own truth and its own ways of making people disappear. I won't tell you where this place is, the dark mesh of woods, meeting the unmarked strip of light, ghost-ridden grass roads, leaf-mold paradise, and I won't tell you what this forest is. So why do we tell each other anything at all? Because we still listen. Because in these times, to listen at all, it is necessary to speak about trees. I have a friend who calls me every Friday morning and hopes I won't answer the phone and leaves me a poem on my message machine. And he left me this poem recently, and I wore my message machine out, backtracking it and writing it down. Wanted to read it to you tonight. What kind of times are these? So I think, I know how important it is for us to find a way to carry our vow and our awareness out into the world. And that does depend on finding a place of refuge, of strength. Of course, the Buddha said within this two fathom foot long body resides all of it is necessary to live and to know suffering and the relief of suffering. That's a definite paraphrase of the Buddha. But his point is that you don't need even a redwood forest, that within the enclosure, within the ecosystem of your own body is the opportunity to make this connection. But it does help us, I really feel. It does help us if we have the chance to now and then deepen our practice by taking refuge in the wider world, finding a homecoming. Attention, the word attention comes from the French, attendre, to stretch toward. Tantra, the cognate, to put together, to stitch together, to stretch toward, to extend yourself. So in these difficult times, a practice that gives us strength and courage and helps to foster attention is incredibly important. So could we encourage each other? Yes, on June 14th, but also on other days to take refuge in the throat of the natural world and listen to the pulse that's beating there. Hear our own deepest request. And remember for a moment what it's like to both leave a trace and erase all trace. Start again. We find fresh life. Anyway, this is what came up for me tonight, driving down to you, thinking about the woods, and then to be greeted by a cousin of the redwood tree here. The last thing I want to say is that one day before the bombing and aggression began in Iraq, this spring, on March 17th, the oldest tree in Muir Woods came crashing down to the ground. Do you know this is an amazing story? A tree that was 700 years old. It was William Kent's favorite tree. William and Elizabeth Kent were the human beings who protected the woods by purchasing them almost 100 years ago and making a gift to the federal government of Muir Woods National Monument, hence Muir Woods National Monument. They beat out the Bohemian Club. They liked the cold and the fog and the quiet. Anyway, William Kent's favorite tree was not a redwood, but a Douglas fir. And it was a marvelous tree, growing, it still is, growing along the banks of Fern Creek, and kind of at the end, the edge margin of Muir Woods. And many of us would make a pilgrimage every time we went to the woods to this tree. I remember going with my daughter's class when she was in third grade, taking about 17 children, literally, to get around that tree with a real wonderful embrace. Not fingertip to fingertip, but like full arm to full arm, the kids hugging that tree, magnificent tree, the tallest and oldest tree in the woods. So a day before the fighting began, or the attack began, at 8:30 at night, there were loud reports. One of the rangers living nearby said he hurried back to the woods because it sounded like cannon fire going off. And he went up with flashlights because the tree had, there'd been a big cut in the tree, a kind of crack. And sure enough, the Kent tree had come down, and when it fell, it was so old and dry and, ripe that it exploded. Just exploded. And, into so many pieces, and the entire forest was astir with this explosion. So I heard and went up at dawn 2 days later, the night the fighting began, or the night the attack began in Iraq. We were ringing the big bell at Green Gulch. You can hear the bell all through the valley. And the next day we heard about this tree, and then the next morning, early at dawn, I went up before anyone was there, all by myself. And it was so powerful to be there. The whole entire part of the forest smelled of the sap, the kind of the bloodline of that ancient one. And it had fallen very gracefully, decapitated two young upstart redwoods. Chink, chink. Got rid of those guys. Move over. Youngins, here I come. And then when it fell on the floor of the forest, that explosion, and I found pieces of wood for so many feet away from the tree, and the tree was still settling. It wasn't safe. You could hear it was still creaking. It was amazing. And I thought, this being is so alive in so-called death, and the forest is made of this life into death into life kind of cycle. That tree will take, as long as it lived upright, it will take to decay. Not quite, because it's not a redwood. Firs go faster. But a redwood would take the exact equivalent time that it stood upright to decay, to come apart. And, you know, they've taken core samples to see how many microorganisms are there on a living tree. I think they found 400 distinct, different organisms growing and living on an upright, living redwood tree. But can you imagine how many on a dead one? Close to 4,000. So many more taking apart. So it seemed fitting and very powerful to be near that tree and to realize what kind of times are these. People came from all over the Bay Area to pay tribute, as you would want to. And it's not too late. When you're in the Bay Area next, do get yourselves out to Muir Woods and walk up to Fern Canyon and see this creature. You can still feel it. Anyway, I'm very much interested in what you'd like to bring up, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to visit and bring you a little taste of our watershed, and not in any way other than to encourage you to know your own place. When you find your place where you are, said Dogen in the 13th century, Dogen Zenji, Japanese monk, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs. So, food for thought. Thank you very much for being able to be here. Please, I'm interested in anything you'd like to bring up, any comments or stories. Come close to the precipice, please. There have been sightings. I'm not sure if in the woods, but we expect that, we think there may be. They're shy. They're a lot shyer than many of the other birds. But it's possible. I wouldn't say no to anything.
One of the best ways to learn if they're there is to go at dawn and then you hear them because their wings make a certain noise.
Oh, beautiful.
They're flying from their nests to the sea. To
yes.
Food, and then come back. Yeah. Some season, probably nesting season, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised. It's a wonderful place. And a place that's been protected for so many years, for close to 100 years.
They supposedly live in the Douglas firs, old Douglas firs.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had.
They could have been living in the Kent tree.
When they fell.
checking out how the people are doing, making sure no Bohemians come through, no Buddha-building Bohemians come through to ruin the quiet of the forest. Please.
Oh, this is a personal question.
That's good.
When you die,
yeah.
Do you want to be buried or cremated?
You know, I've been thinking about it a lot, and I've heard of this wonderful, these wonderful woven reed coffins. Have you heard about this? Mm-hmm. In England. Because I always thought I would be cremated because I didn't want to take up much ground. But now that I know from attending my parents throughout their illness and actually attending both of their cremations and their burials, and actually having presided at a number of cremations, I'm aware of how much chemistry is involved in cremation, that it's not as clean as I thought it was. So I've taken to wondering about these $79 woven reed coffins that you can get in England. I think things are a lot simpler in England. You can be returned to the ground. It's almost like being wrapped in a reed shroud and letting the microbes have a feast. There's a wonderful story of a 4th century Christian saint who was a great gardener and considered a heretic because he spoke truth to power. And he was pursued. He lived outside of Constantinople. And some people from the Pope came and said, "We're looking for," I don't remember his name, "do you know where he is?" And the man said, "Yes, I do. But you know, it's late. And let me make you comfortable tonight. Spend the night here and I'll take you to him in the morning." So the soldier stayed with this gardener. And in the morning, they found him in the garden digging a huge hole. And they said, "Thank you for your hospitality. It was wonderful staying here. Now, can you direct us, please, to this saint?" And he said, "I am he." And they recoiled. They didn't want to kill him. He'd been their host. And he said, "Please return me to the ground that I've been gardening. And you've got to fulfill your destiny, and so do I." Wonderful story. He was canonized as the saint, as the saint of the garden for making that choice. Wonderful story. And so I think that's quite enticing. Food for thought. Food for thought and for the worms. Yeah. I'd rather not generate more business for the Industrial Growth Society. I'd love to just go in, lie down. I'd love to be in the compost heap, but then somebody would have to deal with my skeleton, and they'd probably, and it wouldn't be insignificant, my skeleton, so that would be a hassle. And besides, the microbes might not like me, so I think maybe going under the ground would be better. I don't mean to be flip, but I have thought about it, so it's interesting you ask. Please. No, I have one of the wonderful things about practicing at any meditation center, but especially at Zen Center, is how all the jobs rotate. So it's healthy to rotate. In fact, I got rotated in before I knew anything about. I spent hours in meditation thinking, if I plant the carrots there and don't put the celery there, it kept me very alert because I knew nothing about gardening. I really learned by the seat of my pants, and I was lucky to be able to work for many years at Green Gulch. Now, there's a beautiful young woman doing the garden. She just had a baby girl on Buddha's birthday. And so it's great having the garden be in Leslie's hands, and she's doing a fantastic job. And whenever she needs some history, I'll come walking up on my cane to tell her what was planted where and when and how. So, and I have been focusing on the book, on this book about gardening and Zen.
Because
yeah. They stopped saying I'm writing a book. Yeah, it was too embarrassing. They said, "You're too late." It's like Methuselah's tooth. It's taking so long. But it has been submitted, dear friends, on March 1st. 660 pages of... I know, I'm going to have to spend years replanting forests to redeem that one. But it's been submitted with the stipulation that it be printed on recycled paper. So I pray. I pray that that won't be ignored, and of course it will be edited. It's been wonderful, wonderful and horrible working on that. Yeah. A different kind of harvest. Please.
You mentioned taking refuge in the
Right.
With the war and everything.
Right.
How do you reconcile and make peace with the fact that there's so much deforestation going on? I mean, that's a war of its own kind.
Right.
And it's happening daily.
Right.
But it's beyond our vision for those of us who don't perhaps live in the woods.
You know, we don't live in the woods, but when we think of the houses of South San Francisco and the whole Bay Area, if we want to really know the life of the forest, we inhabit it in our homes, you know, in horizontal. We've made the forest horizontal in our homes. So it's possible to connect with that truth in many different ways. One of my closest friends, a young woman who was in our first apprenticeship class, and I know it's late and I'll stop after this. Jenny was took her practice and her training at Zen Center and went and lived in the old growth forest in Humboldt County up in the Headwaters Forest. And to our horror, one day we opened up the Chronicle and saw a picture of Jenny with her head being pulled back and pepper spray being put underneath her eyelids. I'm sure you remember that photograph. That was our Jenny. And it really hit home. So I went north right after that with two students who I'm still really close to, two young apprentices. And we spent a week working in the for the benefit of the forest, doing whatever we could. We did a very simple action, you know, which was in a way ridiculous. Women taking balls of yarn, we yarned the road leading from Pacific Lumber into the forest. We covered the road with a web of yarn. And when the forest trucks came out in the morning, there was this spider web made of yarn and women singing and making yarn. And one of the truck drivers got out and said, "This is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. This is so stupid." And then, but he couldn't cut through it. And literally. So he got all ensnared in the web, and we kept yarning and singing and till the sheriff came, and they cut through with knives, and they were really angry at us. But we held them back we made them 2 or 3 hours late for work, and I'm really glad we did that. I'll never forget it. I still have a ball of yarn on my altar. And you know, one of the more courageous women, when the sheriff came out and was hacking through the web with his shears and knives, she went into his car where he'd left his gun in the holster and yarned the gun with blue and pink yarn. And just tied it in a bow and put a little heart on the gun. So, I mean, it's pathetic, but it felt really good to be there and to make that effort and to try, to really try, not to overuse wood products. I'd made a pledge that when we drove north, every time we passed a lumber truck, I'd put my hands together, heart and mind together in the present moment. And I tell you, almost the whole way up the road, I was in steady gusho because there were lumber trucks coming. It is amazing to see what's happening up there. They're cutting around the clock, night and day, and these are the times we're living in. So to take refuge in the Muir Woods becomes a postage stamp, a museum within a frenzied world of what was once 4 million acres. 2 to 3% of that's meant standing, and you know. Practitioners evolve with the trees. Our meditation comes from the roots of the trees up, from that interconnected net. So, of course, we take our place however we can, even with the most ridiculous effort, like yarning the road that winter morning. Yeah. Bringing food to Food Not Bombs was cooking for the activists. So we brought food from our farm. In Nancy's old dilapidated Mercedes car, which was about 35 years old, and the activists all thought we were infiltrators from the FBI. It was hilarious. But eventually we got to know each other and to trust each other. So it was a very good experience. And my friend lived up there for a number of years. We did other work too. So That's tokenism, but it was very important for me. Well, thank you for asking. 9:04. Shut the door. And there'll be no more. Thank you very much. Please come visit us at Zen Center and in the woods. And thank you again for inviting me.